ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, in the wake of the Bondi attack, a Sydney council shuts down a prayer hall run by a notorious preacher. Also, the Prime Minister announces plans to tighten politicians' travel entitlements, and Queensland works on a new strategy to protect its koalas.
What we aim to do then is to radiate out that level of care and commitment. So we should have in the north part of the Gold Coast the healthiest koala population that exists in this country.
The Prime Minister has accused the federal opposition of politicising its response to the Bondi terror attack. Anthony Albanese says in the wake of the 1996 Port Arthur massacre, the then Labor opposition supported the decision of the Howard government not to hold a royal commission. The disharmony at the federal level contrasts with the situation in New South Wales, where the Premier has thanked the Liberal opposition leader for taking a bipartisan approach to proposed hate speech and gun laws. Rachel Mealy reports.
The New South Wales Premier says the hate speech and firearm legislation currently before the state's parliament will keep people safe. The bill aims to outlaw T-shirts, banners and posters bearing hurtful slogans, and it would allow authorities to prohibit mass demonstrations for a period of up to 3 months after a terror declaration is made.
These are big changes in New South Wales, and I don't think I can beat around the bush about what the implications are for the state. I know it's a big change to ensure there's no Form 1 protest during a terrorism designation. So we need to explain why we've pursued those extraordinary changes in New South Wales.
He says words lead to actions, and the pro-Palestinian protests which went ahead in Sydney were a central part of the Bondi attack.
How can it be that a protest can take place in the state and there's a swastika tattooed on the Star of David on a poster in the middle of the city, or photos of the Ayatollah, the leader of Iran, or posters or flags of Hezbollah or Hamas, shirts saying death to the IDF, other shirts that says all Zionists are neo-Nazis.
A coalition of activist groups, along with the Civil Liberties Movement, have announced they'll launch a constitutional challenge to the anti-protest laws. Palestine Action Group organiser Josh Lees says the laws are undemocratic.
This is the latest set of Chris Minns' knee-jerk, undemocratic anti-protest laws, which are being passed again on the basis of a series of lies and misinformation, an outrageous conflating of this horrible anti-Semitic attack at Bondi with the protest movement more broadly.
The Premier Chris Minns says he's confident the legislation will stand up to a constitutional challenge.
All I will say is that we've run our legislation thoroughly through the Crown Solicitor. We are alive to the threat from the High Court and a reversal of these changes. And in some cases that's tempered us in terms of rushing into bills. In other cases, we don't think we can wait, but we're all confident that they're sound constitutionally. But I'm not second-guessing or, I guess, front-running the High Court. They've got to make the decision on it.
For its part, the federal government is drafting the laws it announced in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke says he's pleased to see all states moving in the right direction.
I expect we'll be in a situation where the Commonwealth legislation to enable everything happens before the state legislation happens in some jurisdictions. Obviously, New South Wales legislation's been happening immediately, some of that.
The Prime Minister was booed as he attended a vigil at Bondi Beach on Sunday night. He says he regrets that politics has played a part in the nation's grief.
This is a time where the nation needs to come together in unity and with that sense of purpose. This is not a time for people to look for political product differentiation for the sake of it.
He says the Labor Party provided support for national unity when it was in opposition.
I just note that there was no Royal Commission called by the Howard government after Port Arthur. There was no Royal Commission called by the Abbott government after the Lindt siege. We provided on both those occasions as the opposition, and I was a part of that opposition, we provided support for national unity at that time.
He continues to reject the call for a federal royal commission, saying a review he's ordered into the attack will suffice.
We know who the perpetrators are here. One of them is dead, and one of them has now been transferred to Long Bay Jail. We know what the motivation is, that they are motivated by the evil ideology of ISIS and a perversion of Islam. We are continuing to investigate whether any other connections can be made.
Probationary Constable Jack Hibbert, who was shot in the head and the shoulder during the Bondi terror attack, has been released from hospital. Constable Hibbert's family says he's recovering and will, quote, need space, support and continued positive thoughts. The family of Constable Scott Dyson, who was also injured in the shooting, says he's woken from his medically induced coma for the first time today.
Rachel Mealy reporting. A prayer centre in Bankstown in Sydney's west is being shut down by the local council after it discovered it didn't have the necessary council permits and was instead recently authorised to operate only as a medical practice. The centre has been run by preacher Wissam Haddad. Counter-terrorism officials have told the ABC the younger Bondi gunman, Naveed Akram, was a follower of Mr Haddad. The mayor of Canterbury Bankstown is a Muslim man, Bilal El Hayek, and the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns praised his leadership and the council's decision today.
It's an illegal premises and it doesn't meet the circumstances or the conditions of its permission. Now that's an important step made by that council. We've been in discussions with the mayor and the general manager for several days now. This is an important change, not just for that community, but for New South Wales. And I want to make it clear, it's not the end of the matter. We need to make decisive steps, whether it's through planning law or hate speech, to send a message to those who are intent on putting hate in people's heart or spreading racism in our community, that they will be met with the full force of the law. And that's exactly what's happened today.
The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns. Well, for more on this story, I spoke to reporter Sean Rubenstein-Dunlop from the ABC Investigations Team. He's reported extensively on the preacher, Wissam Haddad.
Well, Wissam Haddad has been on ASIO's radar for about two decades. He is a prominent radical preacher in Sydney. In fact, in a Four Corners investigation earlier this year, we identified him as a spiritual leader for Australia's pro-Islamic State network. And he sits at the centre of a network of Australian and international terrorists and jihadi leaders abroad. He has been tied to a whole swathe of terrorists who have been convicted over plots and attacks in Australia and abroad. He has bragged about his friendships with senior Australian ISIS fighters during the Syrian war, like Khalid Sharif and Mohammed Elamar, who became notorious for holding up severed heads, one of them standing alongside his children. So Wissam Haddad has been a notorious figure for a very long time and has been promoting the ideology of the Islamic State terrorist group and radicalising generations of young Australians. Certainly a great concern for counter-terrorism authorities for many years.
And Sean, he's faced legal proceedings in the past. Why was that?
Only earlier this year, the federal court found that he'd breached the Racial Discrimination Act for anti-Semitic lectures at his Bankstown Prayer Centre, which is now being shut down. He preaches a violent anti-Semitic message, sometimes quoting religious passages about the killing of Jews. And it was a peak Jewish group, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, who ultimately took him to the federal court and won in their bid against him. He has been investigated over the years by counter-terrorism police, but never himself charged with a terrorism offence. even though, as I said, close ties to many terrorists and extremists, and is seen as a key radicalising force in Australia's small, violent extremist community.
Are you surprised, Sean, that the council has just discovered that the building in Bankstown didn't have the proper approvals to operate as a prayer hall?
I am surprised because Al Medina Dawah Centre has been the focus of media reporting for several years now. Concerns aired in newspaper reports, on the Four Corners program earlier this year as well, about this centre being a hub for radicalisation in Sydney. We interviewed a former ASIO agent who infiltrated that centre and described it as being like an ISIS camp for young people, where they were indoctrinated with ISIS ideology. So the fact that the council would only act now to shut it down, I think raises serious questions about whether they looked into this earlier, and if not, why not?
Reporter Sean Rubenstein Dunlop from the ABC investigations team. And through a lawyer earlier this week, Wissam Haddad said he vehemently denies any knowledge or involvement in the shootings that took place at Bondi Beach. The Prime Minister has today announced a number of proposed changes to the rules regarding politicians' travel entitlements. The revisions come after revelations earlier this month that a number of federal pollies, including the Sport Minister Annika Wells, collectively claimed hundreds of thousands of dollars for family-related travel expenses. Julia Bergen has more.
The amount of taxpayer dollars that federal politicians spend ferrying their families around Australia has been under the microscope. $700,000 for getting them to and from Canberra, $400,000 to fly elsewhere in the country, and $60,000 on chauffeured cars. That comes from an analysis by the ABC, and the call for change has been getting louder. Today, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says that could be about to happen.
And those proposed changes would be, firstly, that all family reunion travel must be booked in economy class. Secondly, to remove access to Australia-wide family reunion travel and restrict to Canberra and within a parliamentarian's local area or electorate. In a senator's case, of course, that's a state.
Currently, federal politicians can claim up to 9 return business class trips from their electorate to Canberra for their spouse, economy class trips for their children, and 3 Australia-wide journeys for their entire family. That's each year. But for senior politicians, there are no caps on flights for family members. It's how Sport and Communications Minister Annika Wells was able to claim thousands of dollars in travel expenses for her husband to attend sporting events. The Prime Minister says a shake-up is coming after a series of recommendations from the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority, or IPIA.
I asked IPIA for advice. I received that advice. We then have acted to refer to the Remuneration Tribunal. They will give consideration to it. That's their job at arm's length. And then the process is they then come back to the government.
That's expected to happen in January next year. But in the interim, some taxpayer money is already coming back. Attorney General Michelle Rowland was told to repay around half of a 2023 trip to Western Australia, which IPIA found was part work and part family holiday. The travel totaled more than $21,000 and family flights cost around $16,000.
I received advice from the independent authority that a portion of that for one use 2.5 years ago was outside the guidelines. So I sought advice on that and repaid that amount. The full figure will be publicly released in time. It was around $10,000.
In a written statement to the ABC, ACT Independent Senator David Pocock says the changes announced by the Prime Minister today are sensible and show the government has sway over the rules. Independent Federal MP Andrew Wilkie says the changes are a solid start but do not go far enough.
I am disappointed to see, though, that there is a carve-out in what's been announced today that if a minister, a senior office holder, say a minister, is invited to, for example, a sporting event interstate, then family reunion travel is still allowed for their family if the minister's been invited in their official capacity.
Andrew Wilkie says this is completely out of step with community expectations.
I never have gone interstate to a sports event on the public dime, but if I was, I think it'd be inappropriate that the taxpayer would pay for my wife to join me, or I can pay for that myself.
Geoffrey Watson is director of the Centre for Public Integrity. He says the changes are common sense.
In a country like Australia with a centralised government in Canberra, you've got to encourage the right people to go there by giving them the opportunities to catch up with their families. So we should be paying for reunions. But the way that it was being misused was really quite disgraceful. People from one capital city were meeting up with their kids who lived in the same capital city in another capital city or at a holiday resort.
Geoffrey Watson would like to see more transparency when findings are made on individual cases of misconduct.
The task actually to keep parliamentarians' expenses in check falls on IPA, and it will refer matters to have them dealt with if it sees fit. But most of them, it just confronts the politician with what in many cases is pretty bad conduct. And if the politician pays back the money, it's no publicity about it. The issue's just papered over.
Geoffrey Watson, SC, is the director of the Centre for Public Integrity. Julia Bergen reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Israeli settlers in the West Bank are pushing ahead with their plans to take greater control of Palestinian territory, even as the US President Donald Trump warns his country will never allow Israel to totally annex the territory. But for some Palestinians and human rights advocates, the situation is somewhat academic. They argue that annexation is already underway as a result of the vice-like control Israel has over the West Bank. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Issa Amro says he lives like a prisoner. His Hebron home on a hill overlooking the city is fortified with gates and fencing in an attempt to shield him from attacks from Israeli settlers he says are supported by the military.
So I'm fenced, caged in my house. My neighbourhood is caged, my city is caged, and my country is caged.
Issa Amro is one of the most outspoken Palestinians on the issue of settler violence and Israeli control of the West Bank.
As a Palestinian, to live in Hebron means you live with fear, no security, no social life, no services, and no recognition as a human being.
Across the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there are roughly 700,000 Israeli settlers living in around 140 settlements and up to 300 outposts. Their presence is considered illegal under international law. But while settlers have been moving into the areas for decades, they've been emboldened in recent times by Israel's government, frequently described as the most right-wing in the country's history.
We're connected to this thing inextricably. We're not going to be connected this way to Brooklyn or to Sydney or Melbourne.
Yishai Fleischer is a settler and the spokesman for the Jewish communities around Hebron and believes other countries, including Australia, need to butt out.
If you don't want us to do our business to survive, if you're standing against Jewish survival and Jewish rights in the land of Israel, in the end that will boomerang onto you.
Is it an either-or prospect, Jewish survival in exchange for Palestinian survival?
You know what? I'll tell you, Jewish survival is paramount for me.
In early December, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his country already has security control of the West Bank.
It has nothing to do with the question of political annexation. That remains a subject of discussion.
Right-wing members of his coalition government are pushing that campaign, including the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, a settler living in Hebron, although they face opposition from the US President Donald Trump.
I will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank. No, I will not allow it.
What countries and leaders say does matter.
Michael Sfard is one of Israel's leading human rights lawyers. He says the situation in the area has deteriorated since the war in Gaza began.
We're perpetuating our domination in the West Bank, and in the last 2 years we've done that in a way that, for me, this is annexation, even if it hasn't been declared.
Issa Amro feels that every day.
So they dream to ethnic cleanse us from our own land.
But criticism doesn't sway people like Yishai Fleischer.
Good people that want to live amongst us, they'll be able to. Haters will have to go.
A simple declaration with major ramifications. This is Matthew Doran in Hebron, reporting for PM.
Back to Australia now, and Queenslanders are being urged to have their say on a new state government plan to protect koalas in the state's southeast. The strategy is aiming to address the habitat loss and disease that have seen the populations dwindle in recent years. Veterinarians have welcomed a commitment of more than $900,000 to help, but some experts say more needs to be done. Elizabeth Cramsey prepared this report.
Within seconds of her cage opening, Piglet the koala latches on to the nearest tree.
Oh, here she goes. Who are you?
She scurries halfway up the trunk and stops to have a look around. Piglet was rescued from this very spot on the Gold Coast almost 2 years ago. Now she's back with a clean bill of health and a two-month-old Joey in her pouch. Michael Hornby is the CEO of Endeavour Veterinary Ecology.
Right behind us here in this habitat, some 400 hectares, was always seen as an ideal koala habitat. And for the most part, that's true. What wasn't known that within this habitat, 65% of the koalas that were living here were not going to be with us for much longer, all of them infected with chlamydial disease.
The Queensland Government has announced a new Koala Ministerial Advisory Council and $950,000 to keep Endeavour Veterinary Ecology working on the ground.
It's going to protect the 120 koalas that are currently residing here, all of whom have been treated by Endeavour Veterinary Ecology to the point where they are all fit and healthy. It is arguably Australia's known healthiest koala population.
Michael Hornby says while koalas have a great ability to adapt to new habitats and neighbourhoods, their connection to other koala populations can be challenging.
Once they're connected, and to retain connection, the hardest thing is when you have chlamydial disease or outbreaks, then you're exposing it to every population that's there. It's almost like trying to capture water. The water's still going to run through unless you can close it off properly. So this becomes a centrepiece because it's got 120 koalas here at the moment. We believe it'll increase dramatically over the next 4 years. But what we aim to do then is to radiate out that level of care and commitment to the populations that then connect to this environment.
The Queensland Government has already committed $80 million to expand protected areas for koalas and wildlife hospitals. Andrew Powell is the Minister for Environment. He says the government's new strategy consists of three parts.
We are launching a discussion paper for Southeast Queensland to have their say on how we ensure we protect this iconic species. We want to look at habitat protection, habitat restoration, monitoring, mapping, the health of koalas. We want to leave no stone unturned, and I want to announce today $950,000 to Endeavour Veterinary Ecology, who do fantastic work here in the Coomera, Pimpamar River area, looking at ensuring the population of koalas is healthy and is going to continue well into the future through their monitoring work.
He's calling on Queenslanders to have their say on the state's next koala protection strategy. But disease isn't the only factor to blame for koalas being officially endangered. The acting director of the Queensland Conservation Council is Anthony Goff.
Now, certainly deforestation and the cutting back of habitat is the primary cause of koala deaths. And the government, state government, has come to the table and provided a lot of funding for koala hospitals and wildlife hospitals. And we welcome that funding. That's really important. But without addressing the fundamental cause, the community will be left caring for more and more sick and injured animals. So the hospitals are absolutely important. There's no doubt about that. But we also need to stop the problem at its root. And that means having a look at our planning system and planning our cities a bit better so that we are not moving further and further out and pushing that urban sprawl into koala habitat.
And to get a good picture of the situation, Anthony Goff wants results from the last koala census released to the public.
The government has never released the koala census data from that time period. So we understand that they've collected that data, but they haven't released it publicly. So we don't really have a true picture and understanding of the population.
Anthony Goff from the Queensland Conservation Council, Elizabeth Cramsey reporting. Finally this evening, the English singer and guitarist Chris Rea has died at the age of 74 after a short illness. Among his songs are Fool If You Think It's Over, which led to a Grammy nomination in 1978, Stainsby Girls and On the Beach. But his biggest hit was Driving Home for Christmas. You may be doing that right now, so we'll end the show tonight with some of that hit from 1980. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Good night. Driving home for Christmas.
just a